Did you know the risk of cancer does not stop at the scene of a fire? Firefighters are constantly exposed to diesel exhaust fumes and other airborne toxins that get trapped inside the station. Protect yourself with MagnaGrip through the combination of MagnaGrip exhaust removal systems and AirHawk air purification systems. Learn more at MagnaGrip.com. This fire engineering podcast is made possible by Tincata Protective Fabrics. The global leader in flame-resistant fabrics, Tincata Protective Fabrics enables millions of people worldwide to be great at what they do. Generations of industry professionals serving in the fire service, industrial, and military industries rely on Tincata Fabrics for safety, comfort, and confidence. From the harshest working conditions to the welcoming site of home, Tincata recognizes the people they're protecting are unique individuals whose lives extend beyond work. Supporting a world of evolving needs, Tincata's innovations lead the way in user-centric design, technology, and sustainability around the globe. To learn more, please visit tincatafabrics.com.
Hey, Halton here, and I just want to take a few seconds to remind you we're just 4 weeks away from FDIC. Hot classes are filling up fast. There is space left in a few of the workshops. Please sign up now. Don't miss out on an opportunity to get CAPC credit, attend some of the greatest events in firefighting. This April, go to FDIC.com.
Hey, welcome to Hump Day Hangout with Fire Engineering and the Clarion Events Group. And it's Hump Day Hangout with the Traditions Training Group and the International Society of Fire Service Instructors. And I said that without stumbling all over myself like I normally do. But hey, it's April, and we know what April brings. It brings FDIC, and we're going to have a full conference. It's at a right date. The weather's going to be great. We know we just can't wait to get back out there and get back to normal. These last two have just been, it's been terrible. I mean, obviously the content's good, but we're going to have everybody back together at the right date. So, obviously Chief Halton's on here. So, you know, every time we do this, we always want to get an update on FDIC, what's happening. And then I'll ask him about these two knuckleheads he's got doing keynote speeches for him. But Bobby, tell us what, you know, the month's coming on here. So.
Yeah, we are right there. I actually leave for the show in 11 days. So get the setup stuff going and get the sites prepped and all that good stuff. A lot of great stuff happening. The Firefighter Cancer Support Network will be having the 5K fun run on Thursday. Really would love your support. If you want to register, they're going to have a table alongside our friends from the National Fallen Firefighters. We're doing stop, drop, rock and roll. They're doing a backyard barbecue. They're doing all kinds of great stuff. The stair climb. So a lot of great events going on. If you've never been to stop, drop, rock and roll, they always have a great band, good food. I think it's like $25. It's unbelievable. And it's a good time. And then the fun run, I think, is $20. But, you know, and you get a great T-shirt and it's for a great cause. And then I'm not sure what the climb costs, but you get a coin and a T-shirt. And it's just, they're just great events. And those three events are really, really important. I know they're not the, you know, well, actually, there is a lot of drinking that goes on at Stop, Drop, Rock and Roll. But the other two are non-alcoholic. And the barbecue is really cool because it's going to be out by the good folks from the Firefighter Combat Challenge. So that'll be really cool. You can go to the barbecue before you head over to the Union Party night on Friday, where there's free beer and a wonderful time. And the Fools event this year is gonna be at the pavilion outside. So go outside, just around the back where we usually gather in the back. The Billy and the guys are putting up a bunch of tents and such. So the Fools thing will be outside in the behind the pavilion. So we'll see you all there Wednesday night after the unplugged session on Wednesday night with Salka and Lasky and Dustin and Chief Norman, which is always a blast. So be sure to see you there. Workshops are going unbelievable, really crowded, and hands-on training is amazing. If you're going to register, some sessions are sold out. So like advanced extrication is sold out on like either Monday or Tuesday morning, but then there are a few open slots left in the other sessions. So, but classes are filling up, like advanced extrication, a couple of classes are completely sold out. Rid Under Fire, Bobby Eckert's class is completely sold out. Some of them are just completely sold out. And we apologize, but there's, you know, it is packed. I mean, hands-on training is just packed. So please, you know, if you're going to hands-on training, remember, if you're an IDLH class where there's live fire, we're going to do fit testing on Sunday. Please come and get fit tested. Our good friends from 3M, Scott Health and Safety, have a new face piece this year. So we want to make sure that the face piece fits your face correctly, because we all got different size faces. So just please make fit testing. And if you've got hair within the seal of the face piece, I'll be there with razors, so you can get the hair out of the seal of the face piece. So you're legal, but we'd appreciate that. So some really great stuff going on that end. Hot classes are just amazing this year, with some really great classes. Scott's going to tell you a little bit about drilling at the speed of flashover, which still has space available in it. It's an amazing class. And Scott and his team built some of the most incredible props you've ever wanted to see. We invested a fortune in building these props that are just built for FDIC for this event. And Scott and his team do an incredible job. You really want to take advantage of drilling at the speed of flashover. If you want to take a class that's really worth your while, load you up with tons of skills, replicable when you get back home, show you how to build the props. These guys and gals are amazing. That it's just one of my favorite classes. So please take advantage of that. Sam Hiddle will be there signing in the author's book. He'll be signing autographs of the books he hasn't written for me yet. And he'll be doing things like that for us. Steve Shaw will be there, although he's not teaching. He's just deadheading on this to probably one of his other many speaking engagements that he does around the world. But he will be there. Ricky will be teaching for me. So that's covered. And what have I forgotten, Ricky?
Your two keynote guys.
Oh, well, those are forgettable guys. I'm just kidding. Dan is going to open up with Sharpen Your Axe on Wednesday. You don't want to miss this. Dan's a ball of fire. Going to be an amazing opening ceremony. Can't wait to hear Dan do that. John Salka is going to get Lifetime Achievement. Our Instructor of the Year this year is Joe Netter, just a super guy. And then, you know, Dan is fired up. And so is Doug. Doug's going to be on Thursday, and he is really amped up. And both these guys, I've known Ricky, Doug, and Dan now, and Sam and the team for over 20 years. And when I first got here about 18 years ago, they said, "Hey, we'd like to do some stuff with you." I said, "I'd love to." We shook hands, and from that point, that's all we've ever had, right, Sam? I mean, that's all we've ever had, right, Ricky? We met in that restaurant in D.C. Yep. What's the name of that joint?
I can't even remember anymore.
Yeah, but
Head Food.
Right, but these are the kinds of men that the handshake is their word, you know. And Steve was just talking earlier about an incident. And his word is his word. If he says he's going to work with you, he's going to work with you. And other people might come and, you know, offer him something better, but he's going to stick to his word. And Dan and Doug and Ricky and all the folks at Tradition Training, they've been that way. They never wavered. And we've done hundreds of things since then, and we've never had a piece of paper go between us, you know, except the author's agreement when you guys write articles. But I mean, as far as you know, doing things together, it's just been an amazing journey, and everybody who gets involved, whether it's, you know, Schultze or everybody at Tradition Training, and just a joy to work with. It really has been, and super, super people, super, super. And I know we tease Sam a lot, but one of the smartest guys I know, and a great fire ground instructor, and a great officer, and just a really good person too. A great dad, and just a really decent guy. And it's the same for the whole team. So please come to opening program. It's going to be just fantastic. If you're a firefighter, EMT, or paramedic, we've got over 40 classes, 48 classes, I believe, that are CAPSE accredited. So if you take them, you can get CE for your EMT license, your first responder license, your paramedic certification that goes towards your annual certification. So while you're at FDIC, so please take advantage of that. Just going to be a wild time. I mean, it's going to be, Friday is going to be a thing called the Gems Games. Please come take a look at this. One of the most amazing things I've ever seen at an event, where they do these really high fidelity competitions with these medic teams that go on. And man, if you've got some good paramedics on your job, you ought to encourage them right now. We still have some spots left open. Only 15 teams can register. I think there's 8 or 9 registered so far. So some slots are open. you don't have to have any special training. You just have to be good field medics, and you can win a trophy, take it home, bragging rights for, you know, team of the year, best medic team of the year. It's free to register. It says $100, but you get the $100 back. But the preliminaries are Tuesday, and then the final competition is on Friday. Really, really, really cool event. So if you know some cool medics out there that are, interested in showing off their stuff, here's a chance to do it. And just a phenomenal deal. So I'm sorry for talking so fast and talking so much, but it's really, really exciting to me. And I love it. I think it's the greatest firefighting event in the world. And that's, I say that without any reservation. It's got nothing to do with me. This event's been going on for almost 94 years, I believe. This is our 94th year, started in 1928. It's us. It's all of us. It's just all of us. It's all the people who are just absolutely obsessed with firefighting, rescue, and all of it that goes with it, getting together to hang out and bounce stuff off one another, you know, with a beer, without a beer, with a coffee, without a coffee, at 5 o'clock in the morning, at, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, at 10 o'clock at night. Everywhere you go, everybody's wearing a blue t-shirt and talking about firefighting, which is just freaking awesome as far as I'm concerned. So it's not Disneyland. We're not pushing any of that agenda. It's really good, wholesome firefighting. So just teasing, a little Disney joke there for you politically connected people. Anyway, enough said. Let's get to the topic of the day. We're going to, I couldn't imagine better guys. I have to drop off a little bit early. I apologize. I got a meeting to get to, but I couldn't imagine a bunch of better people talk about company officer roles and responsibilities. And Ricky and I have been having a debate. We're kind of on the same page on this about the company officer on the fire ground. So I'd love to hear how Steve and Sam feel about it and Scott about where we're going. In terms of the roles and responsibilities for the company officer on the fire ground. And I know, the size and shape of your organization and the consequent, the circumstances around each event should predicate it. But in some places they've kind of codified what they expect folks to do. And it's almost, irrevocable. You have to stay within these boundaries. Other places are more flexible. But I guess that's kind of where we want to go today, right, Reggie?
Yep. I just wanted to make sure that everybody understood that Sammy's class is at 3:30 on Wednesday at FDIC. And then if you wanted to have dinner before, it might be a good idea. Sammy has 674 slides for his hour and 45-minute class. So you might want to grab something to eat. I'm quite sure that you're going to run over into the panel talk in the afternoon with Sammy. So, but he's been on a roll the last month, giving the classes, Andy Fredericks and everywhere else. So I'm sure he's got it fine tuned in. So like Chief Halton was saying, we wanted to talk about the expectations of the company officers. I think this is a huge topic that doesn't get talked about a lot. And we'll talk to, Florida Shaw as opposed to Virginia Shaw. And Sammy and Scott Kraut. So it's where we're at. So, I mean, obviously I haven't been riding a road for the Tampa fire truck for a while, obviously with this gray hair, that tells you that I haven't been there, but mine was, you got an address, you looked up a hydrant, you said you're responding, and you marked on the scene, and it was nothing elaborate, fire, smoke, nothing evident. And then you went out and you did your job, and then that was it. Today, the person riding the right front seat is just the amount of information they have to transmit, the amount of information they have to take in and then, regurgitate back out. It's incredible. And I don't think we do the company officer enough justice today. There's a lot of classes at FDIC about being a company officer, but I just don't think it really covers, hey, the decision-making processes, how do you get this information? How do you get the experience? And, obviously we have three different areas of the world here that have company officers that, obviously I was Scott's driver when he first became a lieutenant, before he was, when he showed up, he was Tommy Gavin from Rescue Me. And, now he's like the premier company officer. So, obviously that evolution from when he was the first company officer at Station 10 with me to where he's at today. You know, that's an interesting topic. And, you know, I've known Sammy since he was been a firefighter in Wichita, and now he's progressed to, you know, the captain of a rescue company, and then all that he has to do, you know. And obviously, you know, Steve Shaw, you know, obviously I know what goes on in Florida, and he can pass that on. So it's just not what I believe. It's a geographical thing. I mean, you know, you could have, it could still be a simple process, but most organizations today are demanding so much of their company officer and setting the tone for the incident and setting the tactics and, you know, into play. And then what training are we giving them? You know, how are we holding them accountable? And then what happens on our fire ground? So, Scott, I know you, Kraut, I know you got you're at work today, so we'll try to get you knocked out quick, so then we can go on to, you know, Chief Shaw and Captain Hiddle. So, I mean, where were you at? You know, obviously, where were you at when, you know, I first got you? So, as a lieutenant.
interesting that you said that, because you're right. I mean, it's changed a lot. Not only from obviously the experience that I've gained since then, but just the fact that, you know, as a lieutenant where I work, you're assigned to the ladder truck. And so, you know, when I first met Ricky, Ricky was driving me on the ladder truck, and roles and responsibilities obviously are different than the engine company where I'm assigned now. But, you know, I with the ladder truck, it was as easy as Ricky said. You marked up and you pretty much went to work based on your SOPs, your SOGs, or you know, any of your guidelines that your department may have. But with the advent of technology and everything that's come since then, you know, they say it helps, and I'm not sure that it does or doesn't. But you're absolutely right in your opening statement that there's a lot to do. You know, books have been written about a 16-point size up and all these other things. And just like we instructed drilling at the speed of flashover, we also know that, you know, that's a lot of stuff for me to take in and then regurgitate for the incident commander who's relying on my situation report in order to set their strategy while I'm engaged in tactics. And I think the biggest, you know, one of the biggest things I've seen lately, when we talked about, you know, what this topic was going to be, is it's almost too much. You know, here in Fairfax, we've gone to this. I obviously, a 360 is very important and is necessary. But, you know, there's a lot going on with that. And I think ultimately, really what we need to be focusing on is, you know, is there fire below us? Yeah, I'm interested in rescues and you know, smoke and fire, where that's showing from, and you know, the egress and ingress and all that. But, you know, really what I'm concerned about on that 360 or that lap is there fire below me? And we've gotten to the point now where, you know, they want us labeling floors, you know, basement 1, 2. And as you know, the structures, you know, depending on your location can vary. And at the end of the day, it's not really that important to me what those floors are, but, you know, where I'm going, what's underneath me. And I understand from the incident commander's perspective, they need to know how we're going to label these floors. But again, you know, somebody has to understand at some point that to get to the point, you know, we really need to sort of lessen the load on the company officer, because there's so much going on. Not only do I have to visually see it, I need to plan my tactics and then relay what I see to the IC so they can develop a strategy. But I guess that's my biggest growth point now is learning the ins and outs of what the new regime wants, what's expected, and just trying to convey that to the IC.
All right, so we'll hit Sammy next. I mean, obviously, Sammy, you've made, you know, you've gone from, you know, firefighter to lieutenant to a captain in the time that I've known you, and it's been a glorious time. I mean, you used to wear a cap, now you wear a Scully. So, but also, you're dealing with a wide range of building construction in Wichita. So, and in Wichita, do you take command or not take command as a engine officer or truck officer?
No, we don't take command. That's one of the things that's a best practice for us is the second due engine will take initial command. Granted, the first due companies, there's an assumption of initial command where they can kind of structure how apparatus needs to come in and start painting the situational picture for us. The second engine for us generally takes command as they're bringing water in. They can kick their people off to do different things. And then our trucks never take command, and the rescues, thank goodness, never do either. So one of the things to play on what Scott was saying is there is a lot of the picture that we have to paint. And if we try to paint it too broad, too quick, then we're not really giving them a picture, right? We're giving them a color. So there's a lot of details that go into that. And I think one of the things that we do well is that report to the incident commander actually gets broken up into two parts. I'm going to give the initial size up as we pull up on the structure, and then the incident commander should expect a second report from the outside vent as he gets around back and has a little more time to look at the situation of what we have, exposures, hazards. We definitely want to call out that basement if we have one, and we're also going to get that back door popped, get a second look at conditions, and hopefully pull someone out if they were trying to get out of the home.
But I mean, that's matured a lot, has it not, from when
Absolutely.
You first started?
Absolutely. And that's one of the things about our organization that I can speak for that's specific to us. You know, we're a big enough department that we get to see some messed up things, but we're also a small enough department that when we recognize that change needs to be made or an adjustment to a best practice needs to occur, then we can get that implemented relatively quickly.
And obviously I've been to your training facilities. I mean, how do your company officers receive all this training to do what they need to do on this fire ground?
You know, a lot of it, again, really comes down to just after action reviews. You know, you've got to analyze every fire. I don't want to mess up Chief Halton's quote, but I had it written down. He basically says, you know, experience without reflection is just interesting. Did I get close on that, Chief?
Perfect.
All right. And that's really what it comes down to. You do. After every fire, you have to evaluate what everyone did. One of the things I like to do is personally go talk to the chief, just he and I, and ask how my communication, whether that helped him, whether it hurt him, and whether our initial actions messed up his strategy or they were in line with what he was thinking. And then we go back at the company level and we address what we could have done better. And the thing is, when you're going to alarms, there's no shortage of training the next day because there's always something to work on if you're willing to identify deficiencies.
I think that brings up, you brought up a good point for me that, I mean, I wrote it down, is just that I think a lot of times with tailboard critiques, while it's great to have, you know, these six or seven company officers of your engines and your trucks at a critique, I think it's also critically important to have a singular tailboard critique with each individual company officer, probably before the big one. So you get a one-on-one conversation. You're not in a crowd. Nothing's being ego driven. You're able to admit mistakes. Because it's kind of hard to make mistakes sometimes in a group of seven or eight people, depending on who you are as a company officer. So I think that's a great point Sammy made about going and be able to go talk to that chief. So Sammy, you got anything else you want to add there?
I would just say, as far as the premise of today's discussion is initial fire ground actions and expectations, right? Like it's already been alluded to, some people have very rigid pre-arrival assignments. Other people don't have any, which to me is just asinine. For us, again, within our personal structure, we have what we consider floating writing assignments, meaning we don't have the amount of resources that some of the other departments have responding. So we have these writing assignments and they're just kind of floating around the cab. And we're talking about as we're coming in, we're listening to what's happening on the fire ground. And we'll try to get it narrowed down to one or two that if this is going on when we get there, then we're going to try to do this. And if this is going on when we get there, then we're going to try to do that. And then we just kind of pull those out of the air and make our assignments and everybody goes to work. But once those assignments are made, the expectations have been made clear through training.
But so as the first due company officer, you as the engine officer can make all these assignments if you need to be, right?
Absolutely. We can call in, we can tell the second due truck, if you're a truck officer, you can tell the second due truck what your expectations of them are. Now, granted, the incident commander, when he gets there, he can change all of that. But as the initial command, you do have that ability to ask for water from here and assign companies as they come in to meet the needs that you see for a successful mitigation.
Yeah, I think that's always Chief Schultz, who couldn't be on today, but I'm obviously Chief Schultz, who my mentor, we always talk about standard operating procedures and, having a plan and all that is, all that goes into effect until the chief gets there. Then when the chief gets there, then it's the chief's call on what needs to be done and how it's going to play out on a fire ground. So, as rigid as I like, and Chief Schultz like rigid SOPs, but they're also very flexible. If you're going to deviate from them, you just have to tell somebody, get it approved. And then of course, once the chief gets there, that's when his plan goes into play rather than the plan that's on a piece of paper. So,
Sam, just a couple of quick questions, if you don't mind. What is the, I'm pretty familiar with Wichita. So on a first alarm assignment box, whatever you call it there, what's the arrival profile on a battalion chief, a district chief, generally speaking?
I mean, as far as how far out they are?
Yeah.
It really depends. We've got what we call fire alley, where if you made a line right through the middle of the city, that's generally where we find most of our alarms. So we have Battalion 1 and Battalion 2. Battalion 1 is in the downtown, so we have a quick response in our high-value district. And then the second battalion, where we actually find the majority of our fires, we also have a very quick response there. And they're responding out of one of our busiest companies out of that house. So those companies generally go straight to work, knowing that the chief is going to only be 30, 45 seconds behind. Now, when you go to the north side of the city where we operate first due, that's where we will have a significant delay of that chief getting there. We'll also have a significant delay of that truck company getting there, which is why as a rescue, we generally operate as the first due truck in our first due area.
So I know exactly what you're talking about. Is it 35? Is it the 35 corridor?
Yeah, it's basically around the 35 area.
Right, that 35 corridor, very industrialized, very built up. You can just imagine the kind of work they get as you drive through. You're like, okay, it's like the kind of work you hope for. You know what I mean? It's those kinds of jobs, right? So given that, right, I think there's some things happening here that I think we need to talk about in terms of building. And Sam said it best. I'm a big fan of pre-arrival assignments, huge fan of it. But I'm a huge fan of it with flexibility, right? In other words, you have to trust your company officers to make decisions outside of those pre-established deals when the needs dictate it. And that comes from diligent training, drill, simulations, all of that goes into it. And I know Wichita invests a lot of that, and you do a lot of it there, because I know you. So my point is on assumption of command. If you've got somebody who like you said, is rolling up with the first alarm basically at the same time, it's almost counterproductive, right, to have somebody assume command and then pass command. The more times you pass command, the more diluted it gets. It's like a telephone game. And also, in my mind, in an urban environment like downtown Wichita or, Baltimore, which we see behind us, and that photo is from, 2 days ago, Ricky, with you, that Baltimore?
Yeah.
Yeah. If you're in an environment like that where you're basically your first alarm assignment almost arrives simultaneously or within, 30, 40 seconds, generally speaking, the redundancy of it is pointless. Whereas a good size up, like, hey, engine one, I'm on scene, we got working fire second floor. It's a walk up or whatever. There's a wooden staircase around the back. You know, it's got flammable shingles, you know, whatever. That kind of information is critically important. And I want people to get that out. So you've got that, you know, you're painting that picture and you're not interfering with what, as Sam put it, the battalion chief or the district chief or whoever is rolling out behind you may want to implement in terms of an overall strategic, you know, operational deal. But, you know, from my point of view, keeping that company officer tactically involved, not strategically involved, but tactically involved at that task and tact level with his crew or her crew, that's critical. Because if she sees something and she says, you know, she was looking at it and thinks, well, we're going to have to go through that garage door because I don't like that entrance. I don't want to go around the back. So we're going to cut that garage door. She may have a perfectly, absolutely solid reason for doing that. That would take her 35 or 45 or maybe a minute to explain on the radio. That's superfluous. That's when the tailgate, you know, the after action, the AR or the tailgate, whatever you call it, when you sit down, and I've done a million of them as guys have and gals have who are listening to us out there. You know, generally speaking, when you say, hey, you know, I thought the fire was in the basement, but we got in, it was actually on the, you know, first floor or whatever. We thought it was on the third floor, it was actually on the second floor. I've never had anybody say, boy, are you an idiot? You know what I mean? Generally speaking, they wait till you leave. Then they say, boy, is he an idiot? No, I'm just teasing. But you know, I mean, generally those AARs, those are great because everybody else was there also. You know, it's not like the fish story. Like I've been at AARs. We used to do our AARs a day or two later. And it didn't even sound like the fire. It was amazing. And half the guys were and gals that were talking weren't even there. You know what I mean? But when you do an AAR and you sit down and say, okay, hey, when I pulled up, this is what I saw, you know, we missed the plug on the corner. So we went over here, you know what I mean? And everybody's like, hey, no problem, man. I get it. You know, you're coming in, you're looking at the job, you drive past the plug, it happens, right? And so the AAR is I found to be a place where reality is reality and everybody was there, you know what I mean? And nobody can make stuff up. So, you know, I always liked the, and it was kind of interesting about your idea, and I kind of like it, like the one-on-one AAR idea. That was new to me. I haven't heard that before, Sam. I like that. There's an article there, Sam, and I want it. Seriously, like the AAR after the AA. Does that make sense to everybody? You know what I'm saying? I mean, I think that's so. To me, that's a big. That's why I like these hangouts because that free flow of information, just like at FDIC. So if you're out there on Facebook world and you're doing this, that's kind of an interesting, you know. That's kind of an interesting follow-up. You know, should the battalion chief or the assistant chief, whoever rolled out, should that person then, you know, hook up with the captains and lieutenants and whatever and say, hey, you want to share anything with me that, you know, that really crystallized or whatever, but really good stuff. I like the fact that it's not, you're not required by law, you know, almost to provide an assumption of command statement just because you pulled up 35 seconds before the assistant chief or even a minute or even 2 minutes. I'm okay with 2 minutes. You know what I mean? Tell us what you got, tell us what you're doing and tell me what you need. You know what I mean? And then get to work and stay with your crew, you know? And then we get to the whole air pack and, you know, the crews are already bundled up and the officer has to get bundled up outside the rig. So, and that's another discussion to have, I think today about how do we manage that? Right. I mean, you know, the Oscar Armstrong III fire, which was a tough fire for our friends. And we lost Oscar Armstrong and he was a great guy by all accounts. Everybody loved him. You know, the crew, the officers were taking care of some other issues and Oscar and the troops thought they could get a quick knock on it. And they got caught in a flashover and with catastrophic results, horrific fatal results. And nobody did, you know, it got read wrong. And I'm not saying it would have been any different or the officer was standing there. All I'm saying is that, you know, I like to keep crew integrity. The officer needs to be with the crew. I like crew integrity on working fires in particular, you know, and take the ladder companies out of it when you separate out. But generally speaking, when you do that, a senior person becomes that default officer when you separate out a ladder company, if you're fortunate enough to have five people on a ladder. And you can do that, so or stick. So, just my thinking. I just it perked my interest when you said that a couple of things, which is why I like hanging around you.
I like hanging around Sammy too. He makes me feel so dumb. And so Florida Shaw, I know what officers and fire departments do on the old west coast of Florida, but I don't know what's going on the east coast of Florida. So fill us in.
So when this subject came across the email, and this is what we're going to be talking about, I couldn't stop smiling because it flooded me with a bunch of great memories from back when I was a company officer. And as you know, I'm an assistant chief now, so I've had a good path, and I see what we're talking about today from a bunch of different lenses. One, having been a company officer at a pretty decent, busy firehouse before going into training, and then from training going into my current role as an assistant chief, I'm seeing it through different ways. But the expectations of that first dude company officer, we've had these conversations before, and we talked about like the leadership part of this and company officer development and influence. And I think that many of us have said, and I personally believe that that company officer is the most influential role in the fire service. I mean, everybody has influence. Everybody, no matter rank or whatever, can have influence, but that company officer has a special position. And I'm just really grateful that I've had that opportunity to be at a company officer level at my own firehouse with my own crew, knowing the influence that you have. So when we're talking about first due considerations, I think back to when I was a company officer and what the expectations were for me. And for us in the South Florida area with Broward County, Miami-Dade, Palm Beach, for the most part, our SOPs are relatively the same. We do take command upon arrival of the structure fire. So it was for me, the engine 46 arrival, single story, single family CBS structure, I get heavy smoke and flames showing from the Alpha Bravo corner. I'm in command, establishing 9th Street command and whatever else that follows after that. So the expectation there was that I would take command and set the tone. And I think you mentioned that first thing, setting the tone. That was the most important thing. And you learn that through training, you learn that through multiple calls, multiple reps, setting the tone. If I sound like a bumbling idiot when I first size that fire up, it's going to be hard to get back on track. But if I do it cool, calm, collected, I know my first due, I know my 360 needs to be done, I know what my crews are going to do, I know my SOPs, it's going to flow smoothly. And that accompany RD up, and the chief coming in after me that's going to shortly take over command, I've set the tone for him. I've set him up for success. It's going to flow smoothly. So it was expected of me to know my first due. It was expected of me to arrive on scene, give a great size up, direct those incoming crews. For our SOPs, they're pretty precise, but there's a little latitude there as well. Everybody knows kind of what the first, second, third engine companies are doing for our SOPs. If I happen to get on scene and attack the fire and get my own water supply, well, the second engine knows that's taken care of. They can do the other function. So there's a little bit of ability to, you know, to pivot, but for the most part, our SOPs are pretty out there and they know what they're doing. In Fort Lauderdale, especially in some areas down here, Miami, the same thing in Palm Beach, we have areas that see a lot of work, and that sets it up for a lot of reps, a lot of opportunities to not only get those reps in yourself, but listen to other company officers, giving those size ups, seeing what goes right and what can be improved and so on and so forth. But the biggest thing I think that resonates with me, Chief, as you said it before, setting the tone. So setting the tone in the beginning and handling those first, let's say, 5 minutes, making sure those first 5 minutes or so go well before the chief arrives and takes over. I will say one thing, as I reflect on when I was a company officer, one thing I should have done more of back then was realize the influence I was having. In other words, everything that I was doing as a company officer, first due or at the firehouse, was being watched. Everything, your words, your actions, the way you train, the way you size the fire, the way you pull the line, the way it deployed, the way you forced that door or didn't, everything was being watched. And looking back, just as a reflection, I wish I just had that more on the forefront of my mind because I was being watched. I was being critiqued, good or bad. So that, and for my eyes as a company officer, that's what the expectations were for me, to be that, to know my first due, give a good size up, follow the SOPs, get it started the right way, set the tone. So when the commander takes over, they've got it set up on a T form. From the training aspect, you know, less tactical, more supportive. Am I providing the training that I need for these guys to get their reps in, to practice their skills so they can look good when they do their size up or their 360 or their skills on scene? Am I giving them the reps? Am I giving them the acquired structures? Am I giving them the opportunities? Are we doing officer development training? Am I promoting that culture of aggressive firefighting that we're known for, like doing that from the training standpoint. And then from my standpoint now, am I supporting the battalion chief of training to get those resources he needs to get everybody trained? Am I setting up the infrastructure for him? Sam mentioned this with PIAs and post-incident analysis. It's so ironic. I just got an email today from one of my chiefs saying, hey, I want to do a PIA on this fire we had last week. Just like we did a few years ago, I want to do video clips, post-incident analysis, videos of who did what and all that kind of jazz. I'm a huge, huge advocate of a PIA or an after-action report. I don't think they get used enough. They are absolutely critical in our learning and our growth right after the fire on scene, whether it's more of a more of an internal thing you do inside your own department or cross-agency. I've been part of many cross-agency ones. And what I found about that, not to drift off on a tangent here, but someone needs to be pushing those. Like, for example, we had a hazmat incident on the highway just north of us where our hazmat team responded. The neighboring department was thinking about doing a PIA. And I'm like, I had to be the one to kind of gently nudge, you know, constant gentle pressure to say, hey, listen, we would go to that. We'd love that if you're thinking about doing that. What do you need from me? And after that gentle nudge, they put together a multi-jurisdictional PIA. It was wonderful. It was awesome. But you need that person kind of gently pushing those, whether it's right after the fire, where is it normal? Is it the consistent thing that happens? Or is it more of a formal thing? So I'm glad that you mentioned the PIAs because those are huge in terms of a learning opportunity. Those are the first things I think of. You know, I'm blessed to see it through different lenses, but at the end of the day, my thought goes back to the influence you have as a first arriving company officer. Is that person setting the tone for the rest of the incident? Because as we all know, those first few minutes are going to set the tone. If we do it right, we set it up the right way, deploy the lines right, ladders right, search right, all that jazz. We set it up very structured for the company officers coming in and everybody else following that. And they listen to us. They're listening. It's the last thing I'll say is this. The thing that first I remember when you put the email out about the content was the way that all goes down when a fire call comes in. Tones go off. Everybody gets in the radio. We're responding. Engine 46 responding. Engine 8 responding. Engine 2, ladder 2. Then there's that moment of silence. And what's everybody waiting for? Everybody's waiting for that first initial responding truck to get there to give their size up. They're waiting for it. You're on stage. You know, how are you going to look? Are you going to do it right? Are you going to call it like you mean it? Are you going to come in there calm? Are you going to set that tone? That was, I think, one of my favorite things of being company officers, listening to those first size ups and being the person that was able to give those first size ups and help set the tone. So those are just a few of my thoughts. And I don't mean to ramble, but I'm really glad we're talking about this. This is an important thing.
You're not rambling in at least a little bit. It was your time. So I got some follow-up questions because I think it's important for everybody to know more or less like, you know, how these fire departments are run. So the three fire departments that we've kind of, you know, swathed across here. So Chief Shaw, so the question I have for you is first, that first command that you take, is it inside or outside? Where is you as the command officer of that first engine? Where are you, inside the building or are you outside the building?
Well, it can transition. So initially, let's take my classic bread and butter fire we have here in my old zone. We have like single story, single family, concrete block and stucco structure. That's our classic bread and butter fire. So I know going into that fire that I got to get there quick because the other trucks are going to race me there. And if I don't get there quick, they're going to beat. So I'm rushing there to get there first. I know that when I give my size up, I'm taking command and I'm command of the scene. So based on our SOPs, based on our training, based on those expectations I give those first arriving companies, we set the tone. I'm still on the outside. And if that chief officer doesn't get there soon enough, I may be on the inside as command still. So for the most part, that's where we're at. Generally speaking, we're a urban enough city to where our chief officers are getting there in a pretty quick time frame, but it doesn't always happen that way. That being said, so it's kind of a transitional area. Most of the time, in my experience, I was always on the outside, maybe getting ready to go in when the chief took over. But there's been times when I've been inside, transferring it that way.
Okay, and what's the crew size in your department?
So we run three-person suppression companies down here. So we got three-person engines, three-person ladders, and 2 to 3-person medical rescue trucks. Now, the medical rescues, technically speaking, they're all fire certified. So they're part of our fire rescue department. We try to get them fire assignments, but you know, a lot of times they're assigned medical if we have a patient or if there's a need for it. So we try to we try to adjust and maybe call an extra one so those initial ones can get in on some on the scene and give us a hand with pulling a line or forcing the door or whatever it is. But that's our layout right there.
Okay, and then so if you take command as that first engine and you're outside the structure, what is your other firefighter doing?
So the firefighter and myself are making entry. The driver's outside getting the line pumped and whatnot. And that's the, I guess that gray area you're talking about. So right now I'm on the outside. I'm doing my 360 while the driver's getting the line pulled. The firefighter's getting the force blow entry to the front door. I'm doing the best 360 I can. And by the time, at least statistically speaking, I'm getting ready to go in or just make entry, the chief's getting there and taking it from there.
Okay, so Sammy, that's good. Now I'm going to kind of go back down to you. So what are the crew sizes in Wichita?
Generally, we ride three when we are in minimum staffing. Rescues are first to get the extra person if we have extra people. Trucks are next to get the extra people, and then we'll start putting extras on the engines. But that rarely happens, so.
So I know you don't like to remember when you actually rode an engine. I know it's a painful experience for you. So if you're the second due engine at a call in Wichita and you're the incident commander, are you inside or outside the structure?
No, we're outside the structure because, like I said, what I would do personally is I would send the engine to go get water. I would have to assume that initial command because we would do a lot of back stretching here for the water. And then that extra firefighter, we could assign them to the fire attack to help with that door position. And that way, once an incident commander got there, then I could meet up with that firefighter who was outside the IDLH and we could initiate a search. We could put a second line in play, whatever that looked like.
All right. And Crowd, are you still with us? Or are you out serving the citizens of Fairfax County?
No, I'm here.
So, and the crew sizes in Fairfax County are now what?
Four for everything.
Four everything. And then does the first engine take command?
It's assumed. We don't have to, some people often do, but we don't have to verbally assume it. It is assumed that we have it until a chief officer gets there. Now, the one thing we are required to do is if I have to go into the IDLH, which is an interior fire, then the expectation for me is to request to transfer, and then the first due battalion chief has the ability to kick that to the second engine if they are delayed, or you know, if they know they're behind the second engine, they have that ability to kick it to the second engine, or they can, you know, basically state that, yeah, I'll be there in 30 seconds. I'll have it.
So for you to transition. So what is your crew doing? If you're staying outside the building, what is your other two firefighters doing? I mean, obviously you know what your driver's doing. So,
yeah, no, for us, they would, you know, I mean, as you know, Ricky, like first engine, I would, if it was a, you know, structure fire, unless it's an outside in fire where we'd have to put water outside first, we'd be inside. So, you know, much like Chief Shaw was stating, like, I'm going to take my 360, I'm going to report back my situation, and then I'm going to explain tactically what I'll be doing. Anybody else that's on the scene, I'll also relay that to the chief. So, you know, we're stretching it's 3/4 through side alpha, number 2 floor, along with, you know, my truck will be doing a primary on number 1. And then, you know, it's not sort of this assignment of you know, test taking, like, I need you to do this, I need you to do that. Basically, it's, you know, the two firefighters will have the line ready. I come back around front, mask up, we go in, I request to transfer the command. And then for, you know, coming out of the multifunction house like I'm at, then it would be, you know, engine and truck 425 entering through side alpha, you know, to for fire extinguishment. So, if for some reason there was an outside, an outside in fire where I just went ahead and assumed the command because I'm not going interior, then my firefighters would be applying water to say the deck or whatever's outside. And then I would have the second engine take the interior.
But those decisions are made up so the chief could deny you going inside then. Is that a true statement or? I mean, obviously, that's rarity.
I mean, I guess in theory, if I said something ridiculous, like, you know, fire showing from all three floors, every window, we'll be stretching a, you know, a garden hose through the front door, then yeah, I mean, they could come back and say, you know, time out. If I don't report a 360, they could certainly, you know, deny access. But yeah, traditionally, it's, you know, that's just going to be assumed that I know what I'm talking about. You know, the only thing that they might do, like I said, is if they're delayed, I don't mean that like delayed, but if they're the second engine is going to be there first and I've reported any substantial fire, they do have the option of having that second engine pick up the command, until they get there.
Okay, so I want to go back to Sammy for a minute, and Chief Shaw, if you need to chime in, just let me know in the chat box, whatever. So Sammy, this first engine that shows up, and you know, we got a working structure fire, which obviously we have a lot of in your department. So I mean, he just gives like an on scene report, and then he just does his engine things, right? Worry about global pictures or anything like that.
No, I mean, like I said, they'll give their on-scene report, and if there's anything outside the norm of what we would consider a best practice, then that's where they need to get on the radio. For instance, if the truck's going to have positioning problems, then they'll get on the radio and say, hey, you need to come in from the north, or the west access is going to be your best option. But they're going to announce their actions, and they're going to go to work.
So they, you know, other than painting the picture, they don't worry about the global incident, I guess, if that's a good term that I don't want to use. So
only if it's outside the norm. If it's pretty straightforward, I mean, and we're all of our departments, you know, we've got an idea where the fire is located at in the city, and with the good structural size up, then we have an idea of the footprint we're walking into. So anything outside the norm, then yeah, they're going to start to delegate some things. Other than that, you know, one of the problems that that we have, and it is frustrating, you know, some of these guys try to talk these fires out, and we have so much radio traffic, and we're trying to articulate what we're seeing to the extent that important radio traffic can't get out.
A lot to be said for that. We have an assistant chief in our department that is like the radio savant, and more or less can go back for every incident that we have. So I had a mayday a couple months ago, and he was able to pull all the radio traffic, every busy signal, every radio transmission that got through, and shows just how many, for lack of a better term, busy signals were on the fire ground of somebody trying to give a radio transmission. And it's astonishing to see how many people want to talk on the radio. And thank goodness they get a lot of busy signals, but I don't want that busy signal to be the mayday or the critical message or a priority message. You know, I don't want that to be the case. You know, we give everybody a radio, and it's the great thing. It's a safety thing. But man, they could just learn, you know, when not to talk on it. That'd be a great thing also. So Chief Shaw, do you got anything you want to add to that, or?
Since you mentioned that, I guess it's nice, you know, being up here. For example, fire comes in and I'm not able to go on scene, just listening to it. It's pleasant to listen to what's happened, because the combination of the experience of the crews in the field, training, the SOPs all merged together. When you listen to the communications, at least down here, it's pretty smooth and it's impressive. Everybody knows what their role is. Everybody knows generally what's being done. And so on your basic bread and butter, it just flows. But because they got that baseline, when weird or abnormal or larger scale hits them, you can at least hear they're starting off strong. And to Sam's point, there might be that situation where they may have to do something unconventional, like maybe pass it over to the next suppression, which rarely happens at all. But is it theoretical? Yeah. But again, because of their experience level, that baseline is that they can start off strong to a weirder incident, a larger scale incident, a bigger incident, strong, and then build up slowly from there, or quickly from there, that is. But Yeah. So I we listen to the radios a lot up here on the calls we get, and we don't seem, just like my perspective or just a blessing for us, we don't seem to have a lot of walking over problems that we hear of a lot. And I give credit to that because of, like I said, the training and the SOPs. People know their roles. They don't have to assign people things that our SOPs already state they're doing. So there's a lot of cohesiveness there.
I gotcha. And Scott, is radio traffic pretty prevalent? It's still in Fairfax, or the amount, I guess?
Yeah, I think, you know, to your point, you know, I think radio discipline is a huge issue. Everybody has one. And as you said, it's a safety deal. As you can remember back, you know, earlier, it was just the engine operator, the truck driver that had the radio, and the officer, and the firefighters didn't. And I agree that they should. You know, we try to train here in my company that, you know, to, if we're operating in the group, you know, we do a lot of work on our radios with gloves and, you know, zero vis, so that, you know, the guys can turn their radios down or off, you know, while they're with me on the line, and then that they're capable of turning it back on. You know, God forbid they get separated or something, but, and that helps. The one thing I did want to mention, though, is, you know, Sammy brought it up earlier, that I think that I think is important is, and it's to your point too, like we've trained, I see it a lot of newer officers that they have this checklist, and I brought it up earlier, the 16-point size up, you know, and they're running around the house, and I want to point this out. I know it's not exactly what we're talking about, but I'd hate for listeners not to hear this, because I think it's important. It's like, what are you looking at? You know what? And that's why I think we've gotten too far with maybe some of the expectations, because, as you know, it's an amped up moment. There's a lot of stress involved. And this just happened about 2 weeks ago and almost ended up at a mayday. We were on fire ground. We were a RIT task force. So we were at our RIT cache ready to go, and had a rocking basement fire. The first three units on the scene were all relatively new. Well, they not relatively, they were brand new officers. And again, I'm not saying it's not that old, you know, millennials or the new officer, but point being is, this is interesting. The first engine officer reported fire showing from number two floor side Charlie. It was a basement fire. There was never fire showing from the number two floor. I got pictures of it. I was there. Never was there fire showing from the number two floor. So I think what that says is, you know, every fire that person probably fought on a computer prior to taking a test, every fire they probably fought afterwards, you know, trying to be a good officer, has probably been on the number two floor. And so I thought it was, you know, really interesting when you talk about the stress and the fact that we're just racing around the house. I was like, wait a minute, what are we looking for? What's important? That person just set fire on number two floor. I mean, it was just crazy. There was never fire on number two floor. So, you know, to the point of the expectations, you know, yes, we need to cover these bases depending on what your predetermined check marks are. You know, is there a basement? Obviously, that's super important. But everything else, it's like, slow down. I don't mean walk, you know, but slow your roll a little bit, because there are critical things. And that was one that was missed. Never notified the basement fire until the third engine got there and realized that it was a basement fire.
I think, you know, when you bring that point up, and I know we're getting close to our time or whatever, is that I think that's one of our failures when we talk about these expectations, is that these company officers get so rushed. Because, I mean, obviously we're operating in a high speed environment. I mean, the quicker we put the fire out, the quicker we make the rescues, the quicker we deploy our tactics, that's going to save lives and save property. But, you know, the process that they have to go through, the company officer today has to go through, is a large series of points and things to take in, things to transmit. And if they get rushed, either by, you know, I think Chief Shaw was talking about how close their companies are together. And they may race to the scene, but it shouldn't be that, you know, the second due engine, the third due engine is rushing this first due engine company officer from doing a good complete job. So that's a critical point. I mean, I've been in Sammy's organization, I mean, those guys all are all go-getters, and everything, but that first due company officer has to be able to take that breath, you know, has to be able to deploy his tactics and shouldn't be bum rushed by the group that's going to show up in the next 4 minutes, what's going to happen. So all great points as we go on to this. So Chief, we're going to get in one more round table real quick. If you want to add anything else as we're getting close to our time. So Scully Cap, do you got anything you want to add there?
Yeah, I would say that understanding time compression and feeling rushed isn't as bad as we think it is. Meaning that we feel like that if we stop to take a cognitive pause, that we're stopping the fire ground. And that's really not the case. When we look at the amount of information we're able to absorb in just a few seconds. The other thing is, you know, that just comes down to crew familiarity. My right-hand guy, he's told me that if he sees me stop on the fire ground, then he knows to just let me have 3 to 5 seconds because I'm trying to process some information. And so he just pauses with me. And then he knows as soon as I'm done with that, then I will give the assignment or the directive.
Very good. Very good. Chief Shaw?
I love what Sam just said. I
do too.
I think it kind of sums up what we've been talking about this entire time. That first ranking officer setting the tone, just like you said in the beginning, Chief. It's they're setting the tone. Those initial actions will have reverberations throughout the entire scene. And I just in the last 5 minutes of that time compression and being felt like there's pressure from the oncoming units. I've been there. I remember that. I remember feelings. I had to get things done before engine 8 rolls in, engine 2 rolls in, ladder 2 rolls in. Part of it was just because I knew that they were going to be watching, and two, part of it was because I didn't want them stealing my line. You know, there's a variety of reasons, but it goes back to what he just said. There's that those first initial actions taken by the company officer are so crucial. Everything is being set by the tone that first officer makes when they get on scene. However you do it, SOPs, dedicated, not whatever it is, but and one step further, the influence you have after this in terms of, you know, how you did, how you deployed the line, how you handled the size up, the 360, the transfer of command, all that's being looked at. So it's I can't say it better than Sam did. I think that was the icing on the cake at the end here.
All right, and Scott Kraut.
Hey, Ricky. No, I think everybody said it well. I mean, at the end of the day, it's a super important topic, and I think you mentioned this earlier, Ricky, is that, you know, we could go on and on about the different aspects of, you know, arrival and the duties. But yeah, I think overall, it's just a matter of knowing that you are setting the tone, that when your feet hit the ground, you're on Front Street, whatever you know, sort of spill out. And, you know, Sammy said it great too. You know, you're starting to paint this picture, but that's all you're doing. You're just starting to paint the picture. And so, you know, things change. It's dynamic. You know, it's a dynamic incident, you know, and so things are always changing, as you all know. But I think that initial sort of here's what I see based on what I see, here's what I'm going to do, and here's what I need done. We'll set the tone for the rest of the incident.
All right. Well, you know, we're pushing right up against the time frame. I'm sure Peter's looking at his watch right now, you know, getting ready to give me a countdown. So, hey, look, if, you know, as Chief Halton, you know, said, you know, if you're going to be at FDIC, stop us in the hall, you know, come to a class, learn all you can get while you're out there. Don't give up any time. You know, Chief Halton's got a great schedule out there, great instructors from across the country. Listen to different viewpoints. Listen to fire departments that are outside your geographic area. So it's good. So, but you know what, you know, one of the things I wanted to mention, and I had forgotten about it till just a couple of minutes ago, is that, you know, Chief Shaw they have a great conference also down in Fort Lauderdale that's coming up in October. So Chief Shaw, how would somebody look up to that? Cause hey, look, there's nothing bad about going to October, going to a fire conference in October in Florida. Let's just get that straight right away. So want to give that a quick plug.
Sure. Yeah. The Fort Lauderdale Fire Expo happens every October in the city of Fort Lauderdale. Battalion Chief Mike Salzano, he's the originator of it and the founder, and he runs it usually. And just to throw it out there, if you're planning on going to Florida to attend the conference, as soon as the information hits the internet, jump on it right away because spots sell out in a day. They're gone. One thing we're known for in Fort Lauderdale is we have a very detailed but open acquired structure program, and we're able to get tons and tons of acquired structures usually. So we've, and to Mike's credit, we've had everything from rows and rows and rows of single family homes to high rises for acquired structures. So I appreciate the plug, Chief Riley. I say that people can monitor on social media, but the big thing is once it gets plugged and once it gets out there, get it because they will be gone in a day.
Yeah, another one that, you know, I want to make sure, you know, obviously FDIC is the premier show, but there's a lot of great conferences out that are locally done. Sammy, Chief Schultz, Doug Mitchell were all just recently in Kentucky doing the Andy Fredericks, which for the very first time they took on the road. April 12th, you need to go, is when the registration opens up for Andy Fredericks in Alexandria. Just like the Fort Lauderdale one, that sells out quickly. You need to set your clock, set your alarm, and get on there. I'm pretty sure you'll get to hear Sammy and Chief Schultz again in Alexandria, so please go out and do that. But other than that, we'll see everybody at FDIC. If not, we'll see you next month with the Traditions Training Group and the International Society of Fire Service Instructors, and we'll get a recap, obviously, from Chief Halton from FDIC. So until we see you next time, everybody have a great day. Thank you.